As Big Van Vader would say, it's time. Jules, we're back at the Gab and Jules Show on a Monday.
Good morning, Gab. Good morning, everyone. Hello, hello.
Football's around the corner. Premier League voting to restart. Serie A coming back with the Coppa Italia June 14th. We're going to have Sid Lowe because La Liga coming back before that even. And, of course, we've got the Bundesliga. Tons and tons to talk about. We'll also have quick hits and the U team, Alphabet 11. On we go. This is where things start getting really, really tricky. Yeah. I'm so psyched to see what we have out there. But let's start at the top on a melancholy note. Obviously, the whole world has watched what's been unfolding overnight, mostly in the U.S. in the last two or three days. With the protests following the death of George Floyd, an African American man in Minneapolis, death at the hands of a policeman who's since been charged with third degree murder. There's a lot of anger, a lot of resentment out there. We're not going to get into that because we're not a political show, but I do invite people to listen. I thought Shaka Hislop very eloquent on this on the FC show. I've tweeted it out. I think he's got a very good handle on sort of the mood out there and also how it relates to professional athletes, which is what I do want to get into because, Jules, it started with Weston McKennie on Saturday. Mm-hmm. You know, he wore an armband that said justice for George Floyd. It continued the following day, or continued later with Marcus Thuram in the Gladbach game. Obviously, Thuram, somebody who's very sensitive to these things. His father, Lilian Thuram, obviously has been a long time a campaigner against yeah. racism. And then obviously continued in the Dortmund game with both Jadon Sancho and Ashraf Hakimi, displaying shirts in support of this justice for George Floyd. When footballers move out of their lane, there are some people who instantly tell them, no, go back into your lane. Marcus Thuram, I should add, his goal celebration, it was basically like Colin Kaepernick kneeling down.
Yeah, kneeling down.
There's no question that they're influenced. I mean, my first thought here is that this really is, as a cliche goes, a global village. This really is a story that maybe it's because we're on lockdown, maybe because the world has already changed. This story really goes all over the world. I get McKennie because he's American, but you know, for the others, they saw this and they still felt affected by it.
Wherever you live, whatever your background is, whatever the skin of your color is, whatever job you are, you're a football player, you work in an office, you're like us, this is a story that should touch you. This is a story that should alert you in what is going wrong in the world right now. And whether you want to go and protest peacefully or not, this is your own choice. But I think your voice is important. Every voice here is important. Of course, football players, maybe more than others, because they are so big. Everybody watches them. Everybody listens to them. Marcus Thuram might not have been much known across the Atlantic before yesterday. But now everybody has seen his goal celebration. Everybody would have researched him and his father, Lilian, like you said, and everything that family has done to fight racism in France, in Europe, and all around the world. And I think it's so important that football players and ones who are playing, others on social media, have also used those platforms to make their voice heard. That's Kylian Mbappe had a lovely messages with emojis on Saturday about it. And I think this is so important. And I think they should be encouraged to do it and not people trying to say to football players, stay and keep what you're doing. And this is not your field, or this is not something that you should be talking about and things
stick
like that.
To what you know.
Never ever say to football players, exactly, not to talk about their feelings or what they think about issues around the world.
I think that's a great point. And I think it's also very difficult for, I mean, there were people of different ethnicities who came out and made the stand. Obviously, Ashraf Hakimi, who's African, but is white.
North African, yeah.
His experience is going to be different to that of Marcus Thuram. So when that's really bugging when people say to stick to what you know, you don't know what these people know. You don't know what they might have felt. You don't know how they're experiencing. Everybody's different. Everybody experiences this differently. That said, there are rules on the books, and I think they're there for a good reason, banning political messages on shirts. This goes back to in England, you had the whole nonsense with the poppy and whatnot. I think, though, and this is kind of my hope, that this message, right, they're not – this simple message, justice for George Floyd. This is something that, you know, when the message is universal, when everybody agrees with it, I think it ceases to be a political message and it becomes a message more of humanity. In the same way that, you know, when FIFA and UEFA send people out with those armbands that say no to racism, yes, if you're a racist, you might say, well, that's a political message because we should be racist. But the reality is the world doesn't see it that way. Most of the world agrees this is a shared value, saying no to racism. And I think wanting justice for somebody who dies at the hands of the police or the people who are supposed to take care of them is completely transversal. I mean, let's not forget, the president of the United States was one of those who asked justice for George Floyd, right, among others. Yeah. So I think, and whichever way you like him, whether you like him or not. So this is something that I think everybody can agree on, whatever your political view. And I think it's something that, a bit like being against racism, a bit like being against sexism, against violence towards women, these are against violence in general. I mean, these are issues which are so transversal that I would be really disappointed if any of these players were, you know, faced sanction for making political gestures.
Yeah, I mean, I find it already incredible that Jadon Sancho got a yellow card, which you reminded to me just before we did the show, because at that, watching the game, I think I was so wonderfully pleased by the message that Jadon Sancho had on his shirt and his action, that I didn't actually see that the referee booked him. And I know this is the rule, and I know this is the process. And
well, that's to be fair, he was booked because he removed his shirt, not because
yes, but there's a
the
reason
message.
Why, you know, Jadon Sancho has scored 15 goals this season. That's the only time where he took the shirt off for a reason. And I think the referee could have seen that. But again, let's not go there. But yeah, let's hope that at least it doesn't go any further than that.
All right, moving on. We had confirmation the Premier League due to come back on the 17th of June. They're going to play the two fixtures that were postponed. One of them, of course, Arsenal and Manchester City. I know we're taking this as a done deal. There are some hoops to continue jumping through because they still have to approve the protocol for it. It feels like this is like one of those like very slow motion car crashes. There's still the neutral venue issue. There's nothing that's going to derail it at this point, right, Jules?
No, it will happen, whether it's the 17th or the week after and the weekend of the 20th, 19th, 20th, 21st or the weekend after. There's no doubt it will happen, but you're right. There's still a few things that maybe people forget about neutral venues, about the protocol, about all of that that we've mentioned regularly on the show. But the good news is that everybody wants to go back playing, that the tests have been all negative from the last batch from last week, so Thursday, Friday batch. No player in the Premier League is positive, which is great news as well. So this is all very encouraging, and you would think that they would find an agreement with the TV rebate, with the neutral venues, even if some games, a few of them, has to be played on neutral ground, maybe. But they will find an agreement, and it will come back either the 17th or the week after that.
Serie A also coming back June 13th and 14th with the semifinals of the Coppa Italia. Inter against Napoli and Milan against Juventus. These are the return legs. The plan is to play the final a couple days later on the 17th. Then the following midweek on the 20th, they're going to play.
You know what I think is really unfair about that? Well, I understand it, that you can start with that. But is that Juventus, if they win the semi-final and then win the final, so then play the final, whether they win it or not, would have had two games two competitive matches before Lazio play their first game. They would have two games behind closed doors before Lazio play their game behind closed doors. And I think in a title race like this that we've hadn't had in Italy for so long, with just 1 point between the two, I think that's a really big advantage for Juventus. And I'm really not happy. Not that it would change anything. But I'm really not happy. No, really. I'm really not happy for Lazio, because I really think that it's an unfair advantage given to Juve that they can have two competitive games at high intensity, or at least that would make them ready to play a high, more high intensity for the first league game going back the following weekend than Lazio would have. Do you agree with me or not? Or do you, I mean, I know they had to find a date to play those games. I get it. But I just think, really?
I think this ties into something else. As far as I know, La Liga and the Bundesliga haven't done this. So the Premier League, I think, will do this. Serie A is also prepared for the possibility that, yeah, we're going to start again, but we may not be able to finish if there is another outbreak or whatnot. And I think this is part of it. I think so. They want to get the Coppa Italia out of the way. They want to get everybody up to speed so they've played the same number of games. And so then they can focus on cramming in all the football that needs to be played. We have 12 rounds to play in Serie A. That's even more than Spain. I mean, that's a third of the season. And so that's why they've set it up this way. Also, another issue in Italy is that as the laws stand right now, as the government rules stand right now, is if you have a positive test, the entire team has to be quarantined for 2 weeks. Now, they hope that that will change as restrictions are eased around the country, the rate of infections going way down. They also hope, frankly, that there's not going to be any positive tests at all because, you know, I think the most recent news in Italy over the past week, they've had, I think in the course of the whole week, they've had something like 3,000 new infections. And they're testing very heavily, you know, whereas here in England, they had 2,000, you know, yesterday alone. So putting those things together, that's why they have this plan B, which, as I mentioned last week, involves the playoffs. They have a plan C, which also involves some complicated algorithm involving strength of schedule, points, games played, whatever, stuff that nobody seems to understand. And of course, all the football folk are like, no, this sucks. Oh, oh, oh. All right, fine, and come up with a better solution. But anyway, they all need to agree on this. Hopefully it's going to be today on Monday that we get the fixtures and we get some agreement on this. One final point on this coronavirus thing. I'm not saying it's the source of spreading the virus everywhere, but this should serve as a reminder. Gian Gasperini, who's the manager of Atalanta, of course, he gave a long interview, and you know, and it was very emotional for him because obviously Atalanta from Bergamo, which is one of the hardest hit places, I think, in Europe, certainly. And he talked about how he couldn't taste his food, he felt weak, he didn't have a fever, but otherwise he had all the coronavirus symptoms, and he sort of forced himself to travel to Valencia with the team. And obviously that Valencia-Atalanta game, you know, people said it created one of the hotspots in Spain. I know scientists disagree on this. But I look back on this and I say, man, that's really freaking irresponsible from you.
And he said in the interview, I thought about death. I thought about dying. You know, he was that ill that he did think maybe this is it. Maybe this is the end. And imagine going back from that. And the perspective that you can have now on life, on football, on everything else. And you're right, it was a very poignant, I thought, interview from him. And then you do wonder now, why on earth did they play that game?
Well, and I wonder, why did he travel?
Why did they travel and why did they play that game, yeah.
You know, I think the argument is going to be, not to bring it back to the plug the last dance once again, the guy is so uber competitive, but I think with hindsight, I hope he recognizes what he did was extremely irresponsible. But hey, we have another league coming back. That is La Liga. And so we bring in a little bit of Sid Lowe.
Let's go. Yeah.
And boom, Jules, as promised, here he is. It's Mr. Sid Lowe, Dr. Sid Lowe, I should say. Sid, thanks for joining us.
You're
the countdown
welcome.
Has begun. I received an email last night from, one of La Liga's PR servants telling me that this was all happening and how excited he was. Weirdly, I received the email in German. I'm really not sure why. But hey, I'm happy. You're happy. How's this going to feel?
I don't know how it's going to feel, to be honest with you. I mean, look, for all of the doubts, for all of the kind of sense of, I don't know what you'd call it, unease, I suppose, at the return of football. I think the bottom line is the immense majority of people want it back. You know, the immense majority of people want to watch football. They're quite excited about it. I must admit, I don't know how long that will last. So, for example, you know, we've talked a lot about the fact that the plan in Spain is to have football every single day. And obviously this is something that other leagues are following. But of course, that's every football every single day spread across the week. So it might well be, and please forgive me for saying this, fans of these two clubs, that the one game on a Tuesday night perhaps is Valladolid against Leganés, say, or Valladolid against Levante, or something like that. And so people aren't necessarily going to be tuning into all of these games.
Well, but I think the original Ronaldo presumably will, right?
Yeah, but I mean, just because he's tuning in doesn't mean we all have to. I mean, there are many things that the original Ronaldo has done that the rest of us have not throughout his career. And so I think that there is an unease about it. But I also think there's this is really important. It's partly about the context, right? So 3 or 4 weeks ago, when Javier Tebas, the president of the league, was being bullish and pushing this through and saying, we're going to get this done, and being quite sort of belligerent almost in the way that he was approaching this, I think a lot of people felt uneasy about it. But of course, that probably failed to see that this was a progression. And so by the time at which the league came back, because there's a difference between players going and training and matches coming back, the context around this will feel less jarring. So there was this sense that, well, how can we play football when, you know, X numbers of people are dying? But of course, this, we're now in a situation where football is coming back when the figures are very low now, when right across the country, it feels like we're getting closer to something that we can kind of all live with. You know, the reopening of terraces, the de-escalation of the lockdown. It now feels that, you know, in terms of the figures, I think I'd be right in saying that something like, I think the figures for COVID-related deaths were around about 35 or 40 last week, the whole week, when we've been looking at figures of 300 or 400 a day. And so it does feel now like the context is more conducive to watching football and enjoying it and not having to feel like, this is a bit wrong. Now, obviously, it's going to feel different because there's no one in the stadium. But there's a little bit of me that thinks that we've kind of had this discussion, haven't we? That we've all accepted now that, at least to start with, it will be football without fans, and so it will feel different. But we've kind of assimilated that now, right?
Yeah, I mean, I want to get your take on this because, you know, one of the things that we know is that there's going to be, you know, there's going to be very late kickoff times, which in Spain makes sense because of the weather and whatever else. I know you complained about in the past. I think you complained about I think it was a 10 o'clock local kickoff time or 11 o'clock. And, you know, it was bringing, you know, disrespect to the fans or whatever. Frankly, given the way Spain works, if you just give us a little insight into Spanish culture, the fact that, you know, Spanish people, especially in summer, and I hate to generalize, they stay up very, very late. It's just some of the biggest TV and radio shows, you know, they come on at 11 p.m. and midnight. This is no different than people staying up to watch a late movie or something. So in some ways, I think culturally, my impression is that especially in the summer months, this totally fits, and this is actually going to be preferable to, you know, playing at like 4 o'clock when, you know, in Seville, you're going to melt.
Yeah, I mean, look, this is the key point, and the doubts about some of the kickoff times, the doubts about some of the kickoff days. So, for example, this big argument that the Federation has been having with La Liga that's ended up in court about whether you play on Fridays and whether you play on Mondays. Of course, that's driven by the difficulties that creates for match day going fans, for stadium going fans, and of course, in an environment in which there are no stadium going fans, some of those problems disappear. So, as you rightly say, so for example, a game that kicks off at 10 o'clock at night. From a TV audience point of view, in particular in the summer months, although we're not actually into summer holiday months, although bizarrely, I suppose we sort of are because schools aren't back yet, you know, so there is no school. So we're sort of in this kind of holiday period. A 10 o'clock kickoff on the TV is not late. It's prime time. You know, that's the right time for kickoffs. And then, as you say, there's the climatological element of this. And you see, for example, I don't know if you noticed this yesterday when La Liga put up its image of the kickoff times of the league. it had four pieces of information on it: the date and the time, the home team, the away team, and the temperatures. And so this is, you know, this is immediately kind of embraced. And because this is something that happens anyway, if you look at the first two rounds of games of La Liga, which normally obviously are played in August, so we normally start around about the second or third week of August, and sometimes the kind of the last couple of games of the season, the back end of May, or sometimes even creeping into early June, kickoffs are always late, because maybe less so in the north of Spain, but certainly down in the south, it is incredibly hot this time of year. And so you can't, you know, I went to Betis's first game of the season against Levante. Was it last year or the year before? Just as a, you know, just as a fan. And I think I'm right in saying it kicked off at 11 o'clock at night. And no one was really complaining. And it's just the local time. And it's, but it's just because, you know, you, and it was incredibly hot in the stadium, even at that time of the night.
I mean, the great thing as well is that we've got a very exciting end of the season, whether that's for the title, obviously, between Barca and Real Madrid, the Champions League places, from Sevilla all the way down to Valencia, from the relegation as well, because even Espanyol now picked up a bit of pace before the break, and now between them and what, Eibar, or maybe even Valladolid, all of them could still go down. So that means there's a lot at stake for everyone pretty much in the league, which makes it even more interesting when it will come back in 10 days' time.
Yeah, absolutely. I don't think there is anything that's done in La Liga now. Now, obviously, we can argue, of course, it's done that Real Madrid and Barcelona will get a Champions League place. But, of course, that's not their target. Their target is the league itself. So I think everything, Champions League places, European places, relegation and the title, they're all still open. And in particular, because, of course, I think we've sort of forgotten this because we're coming into summer. There's actually quite a lot of the league still to go. 11 weeks is a lot of games worth of football, and a lot of weeks worth of football at a time when we don't know how teams will respond. So as you rightly so, it may well be, rightly say, it may well be that teams all the way up to halfway and beyond in La Liga could be dragged into relegation zone. What if you have a team that for whatever reason doesn't respond well to this restart? And it doesn't respond well to, I know, playing in empty stadiums. Maybe they're not as fit as they were. Maybe emotionally and psychologically they've disengaged through this whole process. All of these things are genuine elements that could have a huge impact on how a team plays. So a team that thinks it's safe could well find, and also this will happen quickly because we're talking about 11 weeks, 11 games, right? But squeezed into 5 weeks. So imagine, you know, you're 2 weeks into this, you respond a little bit sluggishly, you've suddenly played four games, lost all four, and a team that thought it was sitting happily in mid-table could well find itself in trouble. So I think all the way through the league, anyway, because of how it's set up in terms of the positions, this would be really exciting. But given all of these, what the Spanish always refer to as kind of incognito, these incognito elements, these things that you don't know. And what do you call that in English? My mind's gone blank. Anyway, these unknowns, I suppose.
No. To quote Donald Rumsfeld, you're talking about known unknowns.
Yeah.
There's also going to be unknown unknowns, and we'll find out what those are later.
Yeah, okay, so these known unknowns and also the unknown unknowns mean there is a lot that we do not know. And because we do not know, this will be very exciting. But I don't know what will be exciting because it's unknown at this stage.
Let's walk through that because we do have a little bit of an indication from what happened to what's been happening in the Bundesliga. And I want to get Jules on this too because we know who the good teams are, we know who the good players are, but we don't know how they're going to be affected by the break, obviously. That's a known unknown. Some of the conventional wisdom, some of the early indications, for example, from the Bundesliga, is that players who are smaller and lighter and have that kind of build will get fitter quicker and will have an impact quicker. Whereas, you know, just not good news for, say, Diego Costa. But, Jules, does that make sense to you? And Sid, are we going to see this?
It makes sense to me. And I think, I do think as well that the style of football in La Liga would be, even with the weather, as we've mentioned, would be far more suited to coming back after this break. It's a very technical football. There's maybe less intensity, or certainly less intensity, less counter-pressing maybe than we can see in the Bundesliga. And I just don't think that we will see some of the game that we've seen in the Bundesliga where maybe the rhythm has dropped a bit, especially with not two of the top teams. And I think I think that La Liga would be more interesting generally in terms of football spectacle than the Bundesliga has been in certain games.
If that's the case, then, Sid, if Dr. Jules is right, does it mean it's bad news for for Bordalas and Getafe and his tripe, which you weirdly pretend to like, and also for Atletico Madrid, perhaps?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, on the face of it, intuitively, it feels like that would make some sense. But obviously, but the other thing is we don't know. Maybe it is that those teams are so adept at doing things that are difficult and they're so inbuilt that they'll get back into them quicker. So maybe the press that Getafe use is so much more kind of, what I call it, so much more ingrained that they can kind of fit back into that mechanism quicker than other teams who maybe need it, if less so, but also need it. I you know, for example, I'll give you a good example of this. The other day, Kike Setien said that he believes that the five substitutes is bad news for Barcelona. Because obviously, intuitively, we all tend to say, and I know me and you have discussed this on Twitter, Gav, that we tend to say that, you know, a bigger club has the advantage with having more substitutes because the quality of the players they bring on is going to be better. As you've rightly said, in part, the question mark is the tail off between the quality of what's on the pitch and the quality of what comes onto the pitch, if you see what I mean. Not necessarily the absolute value, but the comparative value. And what Setien said was that, and also what he didn't say, but what I think he was probably implying was, my bench is nowhere near as good as my starting 11 here. But what he actually said was, we are a team that, because of the nature of the way we play, we score a lot of goals late in games because of, if you like, the you know, and this is the argument about Barcelona. What, you know, what's the point of all these passes? How many of these passes are worthwhile? The argument would be, well, all of them are, because it's all part of a cumulative process that means that teams tire late in games. And Setien said, we take advantage of that a lot late in games. And with five substitutes, we're going to find it harder to take advantage of that, harder to have this, if you like, cumulative effect of possession grinding down the other team, and then bang, the goal comes in the last 10 minutes. Where it's less likely to come in the last 10 minutes if that team can put five substitutes on the pitch. And intuitively, I don't know what the impact of this is going to be. It feels like what Jules says makes sense, that like more agile, more life players and are going to have an impact. But it's so difficult to know how this is going to work, whether players can connect, whether players can be emotionally ready as well for this.
Two more quick things for you. One is, a big thanks to our colleague Tom King, and we just messaged through with this news, although I suspect we kind of knew this was happening. Today is June 1st, which means it is no longer May, which means that the clause whereby Lionel Messi could leave on a free transfer from Barcelona has expired. So Lionel Messi will be staying. You must be absolutely shocked at this development.
I hadn't even realized. I'd completely forgotten about that clause. And now that you've told me, I am absolutely shocked. I mean, look, I did think that at the back end of the season, this would be used as leverage. And I suspect that probably behind the scenes, it may well have been. But
a bit late for that now, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, the coronavirus has ruined Real Oviedo's big plans to sign Lionel Messi in the free transfer this summer.
And of course, Lautaro and his big plans to go and you know, threaten to throw a strop if Lautaro Martinez and Neymar didn't come, as some people had suggested he would do. The other thing is very simple. We love our predictions. It's 2 points. And we have all these known unknowns, so nobody's going to hold you to what you think. But since I have to ask you, who do you think is best placed to win La Liga?
Right, the first thing to say here, Gab, is that you've just said there are all these known unknowns and so on. One known that we know, and we know very well, is that people absolutely 100% will hold me to this prediction, no matter what happens.
I know.
Yeah. You my friend, are a liar. Exactly. I honestly... I really, because of these unknowns, I genuinely don't know how teams will respond. I do feel like, to go back to Jules's original point, it sort of feels like Barcelona style should make sense for this, that a team that circulates the ball should be benefited by this, that a team that, while it may not have had as clear an identity in recent years as we thought, does have an identity and does have a player who technically is so much better than everyone else, that if we take away all those extraneous factors, surely in normal circumstances, and particularly if what they tell us is true, which is that Messi in training is even more amazing than Messi in matches, maybe that makes Barcelona favourites. But I just wonder about just that feeling that you always have with Real Madrid, that every time it looks like it's slipping away from them, if they're let off, they tend not to let that slip away from them. So, you know, they dropped 2 points behind Barcelona. They trailed Manchester City in the Champions League. Everything stopped. And it's sort of difficult not to imagine Madrid with that kind of ability they have to kind of go, oh, someone's given us another chance. Thanks very much.
You're right. That must be why they've won all those league titles over the last decade. Well,
and here comes the answer.
Got you there.
No, because here comes the answer. Because that is exactly the point. The league titles tend to be a thing of regularity throughout the season, and Madrid sort of have drifted away from it before it even happens. When they are still in with a chance of the league title at this stage of the season, they tend to get it, which is not very often, because normally Barcelona have blown them out of the water by now. So the short answer is, how are you done me?
Jules, I
think Barcelona are favourites just about.
All right, Jules, shall we say au revoir to our bespectacled friend?
Yes, we should, and maybe we can come back to preview, actually, the return of La Liga next week.
Yeah, that'd be good. And maybe this tape will self-destruct us just before I say which team is going to win the league.
You know, there might be health and safety issues with doing that, Jules, asking Sid to preview the rest of La Liga, because all those known unknowns and unknown unknowns and all those splinters in his backside, you know, I'm not sure about that.
Yeah,
Sid, thanks so much. Okay, enough of Dr. Sid. Let's send him off for his post-lunch siesta. And let's go with some quick hits instead.
Let's go, Gab.
Vincent Kompany has reportedly turned down a chance to return to Manchester City as an assistant to Pep Guardiola. Jules, wise move, if true?
This one really interests me and fascinates me. And I don't know what you think about it, but it's either he doesn't really think that he needs to go back and learn from Pep and learn as an assistant, which a lot of, you would think, young managers or wannabe managers want to do. We can name a lot of them. Maybe he thinks that he's in the right place now, Anderlecht, although things are not going that great for him, haven't been that great for him this season, that he doesn't need to go back to being number two or number three somewhere. It's much better being number one where he is. But other than that, surely if you were given the opportunity to go and work with Pep, you know, in that matter, not as a player manager kind of relationship, but manager to manager relationship, assistant learning, setting up training sessions, you know that your voice would be heard, because that's what Pep does if he takes you as an assistant, as we saw with Arteta again. I find it really strange that he didn't take that opportunity. Maybe
I disagree. I think it would be a step back, frankly. He had a lot of insight. He spent freaking 4 years under Pep Guardiola.
Yeah, like, as a player,
right? Not as a player, as a captain, as a legend, as whatever. Yeah. I think, and also he made a commitment to Anderlecht. You know, we get into this idea that, oh, like, you know, the Premier League and whatever, but dude, the guy's Belgian, he's from Brussels. He made a commitment to the club. He's learned, he knows that he can walk into Manchester City tomorrow and get all the benefits of being a Manchester City legend in terms of contacts and understanding. I don't know. I have no problem with it. I mean, obviously he knows what's best, but, you know, to go back that way, I don't know. I don't think it's necessary. If he doesn't feel it's necessary, then it's not necessary. So there.
Fair enough. Mauricio Pochettino has told La Liga TV that his Southampton team in 2013-14 was revolutionary in changing the mindset of English football. I mean, Gab, this is a huge statement, right? Is he right?
Yeah, and to be fair to Pochettino, he's not just talking about his football and what he brought. He's talking about the way Southampton did things with the scouting. If you remember, this guy, Nicola Cortese, took over this... and in terms of running the club, and they started instituting all these things that kind of weren't done before, right? They had like a proper recruiting thing, you know, no more of this, you know, manager decides everything, decides the signings and whatever. He overhauled the medical staff. He brought in a lot of innovations, which at some clubs in England had already come in.
I remember when the story broke in England, I think it was maybe the Daily Mirror, because I remember well, because Nigel Adkins did a decent job at Southampton, and then people were outraged that he was sacked and that this guy Pochettino that people had never heard of was arriving. And we're like, this is so English, isn't it? It's just like, oh, okay, you don't give the guy a chance. You have seen nothing that he did with the Espanyol. You don't know him as a player before. You don't know his philosophy. You don't know the Bielsa link or nothing like that. And people just almost already slagged him off before he even arrived.
I mean, to be fair to Nigel Atkins, given the success he's enjoyed in the Premier League since then, no, I'm just kidding. I don't want to, Nigel Atkins represented a marked improvement from the guy before him, right?
He
was Alan Pardew, and you know, who's falling out with Cortez and whatever, just wasn't going to be part of the restructuring of the club. People felt bad for Atkins. I felt bad for him too, but you know, I always go back to this. You should replace your manager if you think you can get somebody better, not based on whether you think your manager's done a good or bad job.
Totally.
There's no question Atkins did a good job, but
I'm with you. That's why I wonder why people still give job to Alan Pardew, because he cannot be better than what you had before. It's impossible.
Stop with the parts. Come on, man. Show the guy some love. Now, Jules, we seem to agree that Bayern had the season locked up after their win over Borussia Dortmund midweek. I'm assuming their 5-0 trouncing of Fortuna Düsseldorf with your boy Benjamin Pavard reaffirming himself as a goal machine at least every May 29th, is it, or whatever that was?
Yeah.
That hasn't changed your mind. And, of course, for those who don't know, that is a reference to that Absurdistan goal that he scored against Argentina in the World Cup.
In 2018. This one was not as good as, you're right, as the incredible half volley against Argentina. But he's better at scoring goals than crossing the ball, which I think for a right back might be an issue at some point. But hey, they've won. They still have to play Bayer Leverkusen, which is next weekend, which is going to be quite fascinating, I think, to see
Bayer Leverkusen then beat them earlier this year. Let's not forget.
Yeah, exactly.
But then again, Bayer Leverkusen means Peter Boss. So
yeah, exactly. And then they also play Mönchengladbach, don't they? Who also have beaten them earlier in the season. So it'd be interesting. I still think, as we said, they've got a title wrapped up. It's no problem at all. And I think they will have a lot of fun between now and the end of the season. And again, I think at the weekend, they were wonderful to watch, albeit against Fortuna Düsseldorf, who, by the way, were so open. I mean, they're trying to play from the back. I mean, come on. Like, you know, don't do that against Bayern Munich, please. It's crazy.
Yeah, I think they kind of drank the Kool-Aid there. I think they also kind of felt like, oh, look, there's all these away wins in the Bundesliga now.
We can do the same.
Let's go and pretend we're at home playing against a third division side. Whatever.
Took Borussia Dortmund a while to get going up against Paderborn on Sunday. It was scoreless at halftime. But they then opened the floodgates and won 6-1. Why did it take so long?
So, I mean, obviously there was no Erling Haaland. And it's not so much that he was missing. It's that when he's not there, the way you play becomes very, very different. When you're going with a front three of Julian Brandt, Jadon Sancho, and Kylian Thorgan Hazard even. Or even more so if that were Kylian Hazard, but of course, it's Thorgan Hazard. you know, you don't have a center forward. It's going to be much more movement based, much more fluid. It doesn't mean you can't score goals, as the evidence by scoring six in the second half, but it is a huge change from what you had before. And I think it takes some adjustment. I mean, I think as a general rule of thumb, if you go with that sort of, you know, not three little guys, but three non-forwards, you either score first and then all of a sudden, you know, the other side team has to come forward and you've got to go and just pick them apart. Or not that Paderborn sat, they didn't do that at all. Or you can just go a long time until you break them down.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's anything particularly to worry about. And Rashan, by the way, shout out to him. Really, really good. And again, you wonder, a fit Sean, a fit Sancho, a different referee. Oh, and by the way, you saw the penalty that was given to Paderborn?
Yeah, given to Paderborn, very similar to the Boateng handball. And that wasn't given.
And wasn't VAR'd.
Right? I know.
Now, I raised this with Sid Lowe on the FC show last night, but want to get your take. Bayern, we take for granted, won't be renewing Philippe Coutinho's loan, which means he has to go back to Barcelona. But is it really such a bad thing if he comes back, considering that he had his issues with Valverde, but now it's Setien who's a different manager?
Yeah, and Setien, who has already said, I would like to have Coutinho back. I would like to play him. I think he fits very well in what Setien is trying to do, the style of football, the formation, all of that. I think that would work. There might be something that we don't know, something maybe like a player very influential in that team that said, you know, I don't fancy Coutinho in this team. I don't want to play with him. I don't know. But other than that, it's really weird how they're trying to offload him all the time, where maybe they can give him actually a second chance and said, you know what, it didn't work out the first time round for whatever reason. Maybe Coutinho was not ready mentally. Maybe just didn't click with Messi and Suarez and the others. But it doesn't mean that the second chance and the second time round, things might not be better. So maybe they could give him a chance. Or maybe they're so bad financially that they have to let him go. They have to get rid of his wages. They have to get a bit of money for him.
Well, I don't think you're going to get any money for him, frankly, at this stage, given his wages. I think they will try to send him on loan somewhere. But, you know, and also if you get rid of him, they kind of made it clear that they want to bring somebody else. And I think if he's there, you can maybe see him operating in midfield, another passer in midfield with the way Setién plays. Who knows? Maybe it'll work.
I think it would work, definitely. Marca in Spain are reporting that Real Madrid seem resigned to doing very little business in the summer since they can't Dembele or James, among others. Gab, is this a problem?
I don't think it is a problem. They have a big squad. They're going to have a bunch of injured guys coming back. They're going to have, hopefully, Ashraf Hakimi coming back. Odriozola, I don't know about. But with Hakimi, all of a sudden, you're set. All of a sudden, you know, you've got the left back position covered, or indeed the right back position, because obviously you can play either flank. That's an immediate upgrade. You can see what the guy can do. You've got Valverde, who's going to be a year more mature. You've got Casemiro, who's locked up.
You've got Modric, who's 55. You keep him and you don't but go you don't, and get my man Paul?
You don't. Yeah, but your man Paul costs money. I'm saying, but you don't. I mean, okay, Modric, I would tend to agree with, but you know what? I mean, Modric doesn't need to start. Modric can be somebody who comes in off the bench if you can't move Modric. James has also played in that midfield three. It's not written strong that you have to play 4-3-3. You can play 4-2-3-1. Maybe there'll be some games when James can contribute. You know, you've got Asensio who's going to come back from injury. So I don't think it's a tragedy at all. You know, I mean, they want Kai Havertz. Maybe this isn't the summer to get him. Hey, that's fine. I think Real Madrid will be more than okay going into next season. And by the way, I know that I'm inviting Barcelona fans to accuse us of being Real Madrid supporters. I'm not. I just think they have a deep side and they're well placed. And
I'm surprised that you like Luka Jovic as Karim Benzema as number two, because there's a problem if Karim Benzema gets injured and you don't have another striker apart from Jovic. I'm not sure we've seen enough and have enough guarantees that Jovic can assume that role and that Real Madrid can keep winning. That's what I'm saying. And Benzema is not getting any younger either. So
no, but you still have Mariano, you still have Vinicius. I don't think...
Who? Yeah. Mariano, come on.
I'm kidding on Mariano. But no, but look, realistically, yes. Obviously, Benzema would be a big loss. But, I mean, in terms of attacking firepower, you still have Vinicius, you still have Rodrigo, you still have Gareth Bale if he's there and he's motivated. So, you know, I generally, you still have Eden Hazard who can score a bunch of goals.
Yeah,
I just think it's less of an issue.
Yeah, you're right.
Now, the Mauro Icardi deal to Paris Saint-Germain is now permanent. Way! My information is that it's 50 million euros plus various bonuses, some of them attainable, some less so, which could rise to 57 million. Jules, it's a little bit less than what Inter were hoping to get, but that hasn't stopped the Monks of Spumante Milan. Is it champagne in Paris?
Yeah, they're very happy. They're very happy, Gab, with the deal, because initially the buyout clause from the loan deal was 70 million euros. So it was significantly less. And again, I think, as I mentioned on the show the other day, is that I think this is maybe an insight of what you will see this summer, is that a player who's worth 70 million or 90 million or 100 million, the value or what people can pay or are ready to pay for him now is suddenly 20 or 30 million pounds cheaper than that. And I think that's exactly what happened with Inter and PSG. Inter recognizing that they wanted to sell him, but they could not have 70 million pounds because of the pandemic and what happened financially to clubs and to PSG. So I think everyone would be happy with the deal, PSG, Inter, and Icardi himself, and Wanda as well, I guess. And they got a very, very good striker for a very good amount of money. I don't think you can get someone of his caliber at that price right now, or even next summer or the summer after that. So I think it would make everybody very happy.
Yeah, I think if you're a PSG fan, you'll be hoping his head remains screwed on right. And that hasn't always been the case. Oh, and I want to say one other point, because
you always had to be negative when he's gone to PSG. No. I don't know why. Clearly, the issue before was Inter and Italy, not also PSG.
There is a pattern there with Inter, to be fair. By the way, I just want to point something else out, too, because I saw some people on social media and saw some people who should know better on Italian television last night saying, oh, well, look, between the Icardi money and the money that they'll get for Perisic, and then if Barcelona want Lautaro Martinez, that's like they'll have like 200 million to spend this summer. They're going to be so good. No, they won't.
No.
Because remember, the Icardi and the Perisic money was money that they were hoping to have last summer, yeah, so that they could meet financial fair play requirements. They're still not out of the woods yet. So no, I don't imagine a gigantic spending spree. And obviously, if Icardi does leave, Lautaro does leave, which I hope he doesn't, but it's up in the air, then they're going to have to replace him. And that's not going to be straightforward. And it's not going to be Cavani either.
You know what that means? That means Alexis Sanchez coming back.
You'll have him back for another year.
The Portuguese league is one of the other leagues coming back as well this week, Gab, on Wednesday. And Porto's leader of Benfica is just 1 point after they turned things around just before we went on to this break. This will keep us entertained, Gab.
Absolutely. In fact, well done to Portugal. I know it's flown a little bit under the radar, but they are, you know, between major and mid-majors, you would say they are the second league to return. I think it's a testament to the work the authorities have done in Portugal. And I'm excited. I want to see a title race. You know, I can put up with the empty stadiums if there's something at stake. And I think this one promises to go down to the wire. Now, Victor Osimhen has been linked with a number of clubs, including Napoli and Spurs. Somebody, by the way, Leo was on speed dial to Napoli, given the way that was Nicolas Pepe last summer. Now it's this dude. But Lille owner Gerard Lopez says it will take Nicolas Pepe-type money to sign him. Jules, your thoughts. Is he worth it, given what a staggering success Pepe was?
Here we go. Osimhen, obviously a very different player, but had a wonderful first season in France after moving from Belgium in the summer, last summer. And yes, I think Lille are expecting or want that kind of money as well. We're talking 70, 80, maybe even a bit more if they can get it. I don't think they would get that kind of offer. They said they've already had. I'm really not sure in this current circumstances that anyone would put that money on Osimhen, but he's 20. He's a wonderful talent. I watched through the weekend his the under-17 World Cup when he was there for Nigeria 5 years ago, where he was incredible, albeit against 17-year-olds. I get that. And Haaland also scored like 9 goals against Honduras in the under-20 World Cup. So it's not. I know it's a different style of football, but still, you could already see 5 years ago what Osimhen had and the talent that he had. So I think for me, it should be on the radar of all the big clubs in Europe. However, will that money arrive? Will that offer be made? I'm not so sure, which could mean that he stays another year. And again, I don't think Lille would have an issue with that. I don't think Osimhen himself would have an issue with that. A bit with similar to Jadon Sancho and Dortmund. If no one can pay the money that he's worth right now and that Lille wants, I think he will stay another year. And that's be very good for Lille and for Ligue 1 as well.
I think he'd be a tremendous fit for Spurs, because in terms of style of play, you know, I'm not saying he's as good, but there are obvious parallels with Harry Kane there. And he could play with Kane. He could play when Kane is not available. And, you know, Osimhen, Kane, Son, Lucas Moura, Bergwijn. Now that's a ton of firepower. And we know, obviously, Mourinho's got good links with that club. So we'll see.
Gab, the situation between Brescia and Cellino, the owner, and Mario Balotelli is getting worse, isn't it? He's not going to finish out this season, is he?
Yeah, so this all has to do with the fact that apparently he wasn't enthusiastic enough in some of these Zoom training sessions during a lockdown. Brescia accused him of missing or it's been reported that he missed some training sessions since then. Balotelli said he was ill and was actually visited by a club doctor. Balotelli came out and he quoted Khalil Gibran, a poem by Khalil Gibran, on social media. It's weird because I don't have a lot of time for Cellino, and I get the uncomfortable notion that, oh, look, Balotelli wasn't as good as we had anticipated. let me rescind his contract, which is the direction in which we're going, so that I don't have to pay him. On the other hand, he also has a clause in his contract where if Brescia get relegated, his contract gets rescinded anyway.
Anyway.
Given that, you know, they're in the bottom two of the table and it's likely they'll get rescinded, I don't know that they need to go there. I don't think, obviously, Balotelli's helped himself equally. And now there's suggestions that he's asking for compensation from the club. I don't quite get this. You don't need to do this if you just want to get out of the club. Equally, the club don't need to turn the screws on him in this way. I just think it's sad. And like I told you last week, I hope we see him in Brazil.
Yeah, and probably that's the only place we'll be able to go anyway. But it was so nice when he came home, wasn't it, to Brescia, although we all knew that it might not end well between him and Cellino. And I just don't think he often works when you go back to your hometown or the club you supported as a kid, or where you started your career 20 years ago or whatever. And that's another example, unfortunately, for him.
Now, you thought I was going to let you get away without mentioning David Luiz again, eh?
I didn't.
No, I'm bringing this up because obviously we touched upon it last week, and this is a bit of an insight into how not just the media, but agents, PR people work. All this detail suddenly came out about how, oh, it wasn't a 2-year deal. It's a 1-year deal with an option for another. Some figures came out in some publications, which have been disputed about the size of the commission paid to his advisors. My understanding is that it's not, I think it was, what was the number quoted? It was 8 million or 6 million, something stupid like that. I think it was more like 1 million. But, you know, 1 million plus the 8 million transfer fee, plus his wages, which are 10 million a year. Bottom line is, if you let David Luiz go now, he will have cost you 19 million. If you keep him around for another season, he will cost you 15 million pounds next year. Now, I don't begrudge footballers making a lot of money, but are you going to get, last week you thought, oh yeah, he's worth it. Is he going to make a 15 million pound contribution to Arsenal next year?
But it's the debate that we had last week, wasn't it? It's like if Arteta thinks...
But now he... 15 million, I mean, I'm saying he would be the third highest paid player at Arsenal after Ozil and Aubameyang. Maybe even the second highest. He might even make a little more than Aubameyang. We know how much Ozil is contributing.
Pepe is on big money as well. And yeah, no, but of course you're right. And I think for all the...
What's the smart move if you're Arsenal? Bring back Saliba. You've got Socrates, and you're sorted.
And even Pablo Mari, if you believe in, you know, tall ex-Brazilian league player, left-footed. And if that's your thing, that's your thing. You know, if that's what you fancy. But I think the right move, you're right, might be to let him go. I tried to make a case last week, and I think I deserve some credit for that, on why maybe you could keep him and this and that. But you're right, the numbers don't really add up for where you are at the club now financially and what you want to do and where you want to be, despite his experience, despite how good he is on the ball, and especially if you take on board the mistakes defensively as well. So, yeah, maybe I'm just sad because he's such a nice guy. I'm sad to see him go, you know.
He is one of the good guys.
And Gab, to finish with, we have a very odd story coming from Mexico. Argentine goalkeeper Nahuel Guzman, who has a very special clause in his contract, the Leo Messi clause. What is that all about?
Yeah, so Guzman was at Newell's Old Boys, which is, of course, from Rosario, which is where Messi's from. And when he left, he's at Tigres now in Mexico. He had a clause inserted in his contract where he can return to Newell's on a free if Lionel Messi returns to play for Newell's Old Boys. I didn't believe this, but apparently it's true. Our colleagues in Argentina are reporting it out. I wonder what the chances are. I think they're roughly the same age, incidentally, and obviously he's a goalkeeper.
So he's 34, Guzman, so slightly older, but yeah, not far.
But he can keep going, so... I just wonder if he just wants to go home, you know.
Yeah.
If he convinces Messi to, at the end of his Barcelona career, to sign like a 1-week contract with Newell's, he can go home. I don't know. It's a weird one, but hey, I don't blame him. Who wouldn't want to play with Lionel Messi, right?
I know, man. I know. I think I'm put a contract close like that in my ESPN contract. You know, if Leo Messi goes back to Argentina, we all move there. We do the podcast from there or the FC shows from there, and we follow Leo. Can you imagine? That won't happen, right? Or do you think they could have? I mean, imagine Sergio Aguero going back to Independiente, having Carlos Tevez still at Boca for whatever reason. We could have games where we could have Messi against Aguero, Tevez against Aguero, Tevez against Messi, plus all the others. Then we think, you know what? Let's do that. Let's all go home. I mean, imagine that.
If you play that game where you say, like, what if all those guys who came through Argentine football or indeed Brazilian football, what if all those guys, like at age 27, 28, or older, they all decide, you know what, screw this. We made enough money in Europe. There's more to life than money. Let's go home.
Can you imagine?
I'm getting excited
now.
That'd be awesome.
Even Falcao going back to River and just like, Falcao, River Plate. I'd be like, what?
Yeah, I'm not holding my breath on that one. Right, so we got on quick hits. It's time for the eagerly awaited Alphabet 11. We said things are going to get difficult when we get closer to the of the alphabet. I had to stretch myself for this one.
Me too. And a lot of our listeners as well, because as we say, some letters, we had a lot of answers. A lot of people sent their teams on Twitter. And this one, a bit like the letter Q, I think it was, not many of you guys could come up with a team. A lot of people said, oh, I've got Upamecano and that's it. A lot of people said, I've got Umtiti and that's it. So well done to the very few who managed to put together a U team. Let's start with Habib 144, who has Sven Ulrich in goal, Upamecano, Bruno Vini, and Umtiti as a back three. Not sure how complementary they are, but anyway, it counts. Cengiz Under, Uremovic, Mateus Uribe, and Frederik Ulvestad in the midfield four. That would mean Under as a very, very attacking sort of like right wing back. But
don't hate.
Yeah, don't hate. And then a front three of Ushua, Anthony Uja, and Enes Unal from Villarreal. So pretty good from Habib. Ibes 16, one of our regulars with a very creative all-Turkish U11. Ooh. Yeah. Sorry for my pronunciation for all our Turkish friends, but, you know, this is the best I could do. Yusal from Istanbulspor in goal. Ural, Unver, Uzlu from Demirspor, and Uludag from Konyaspor at the back. Uça from Başakşehir. Ulsal from Beşiktaş and Uçan from Alanyaspor, and then a front three of Under, Uzun, and Unal. Pretty good. Sponsor is Ulke, as you would imagine, and Uygun, the manager, Budin Uygun. So well done again to EBES 16.
I don't even know how people manage women's teams with this.
I know, but you have one? You have Sophie?
I do. Sophie Lawson coming up big again. Oh, in goal, Naroa Uriarte, Carly Udenberg, Elvira Urazaeva, and Marta Unzue at the back. Rumi Utsugi, Catalina Uzme, Ichaso Uriarte in midfield. And up front, it's Choma Ubogagu, Lisa Marie Uklund, and Ini Umotong. How about that?
Good. Well, I'll raise you my Miguel Galanz, Women 11, starting with you. Ubaldo from Mexico in goal. Ushijima Urakawa from Japan, with Ueno from Japan as well, and Ulacio from Venezuela at the back. Utsugi.
Anyway, that's a totally different back five so far to Sophie's team.
I mean, I know every week we say, like, how did both come up with, like, so many different names? Incredible. So Utsugi, Uchendu, and Uzme from Colombia in the midfield three for Miguel, and up front, Ubogagu, as Sophie had in her team as well, the English striker, Ueno from Japan, and Ueki from Japan as well. So, very strong 11 from Miguel as well, especially with the Japanese players.
Very, very impressive. You want to hear my team now?
Yeah, right? Let's go.
All right. So in goal, no Sven Ulreich, because I have too many Germans in my team already. So I went with, of course, the legendary Kosovar Samir Ushkani, who's backing up Sirigu in Torino.
So you put a keeper that never plays, right? Is that who you have in
mind? Sorry. Unlike Sven Ulreich, who plays every week. Come on, man.
What, PSV Eindhoven? I have a player who starts by you, plays every week. But it's okay. My team would be your team. Go on. Continue. Like, who else you are from your bench?
I had to break my rule and go with a back three.
Okay.
So I have Samuel Umtiti, Felix Urukai from Augsburg, and of course, Dayot Upamecano as my center backs. My wing backs, and this is where we're gonna get upset, but hey,
Cengiz
Under is going to have to adapt himself.
Yeah, work for the team. He defends so well. Yeah, yeah.
And I've got Mathieu Oudol from Metz on the left.
Nice, yeah.
And then my central midfielders are Andres Uribe and somebody you probably haven't heard of, Yinoma Udogi, who is an Italian under 19 international left-footed defender or midfielder.
Are you made up that name? Did you make him up?
Italian dude of, I'm guessing, probably Nigerian or some other kind of West African descent. Nothing wrong with that.
Right. Okay.
And then up front, Mark Oot, Anthony Uja from Union Berlin, and of course, Ines Unal from Valladolid. I wonder if he's got Ronaldo's personal mobile number. That would be the original Ronaldo, of course, his present.
Yeah. Right. I mean, I don't know where to start with my team, but at least I've put Cengiz Under in his right position, which is a right winger, not like a wing back or whatever. Yeah. I've got Unistal Gold from PSV, who's had a solid season in the Eredivisie, who, you know, he plays, he's paid to play and he plays. That's what he does. I've got a back four of Jere Uronen from Genk at right back and Andreas Ulmer from Salzburg at left back, who, by the way, Salzburg, well done to them, lifted the Austrian Cup. I don't know if you saw at the weekend Jesse Marsh's team and had to do the whole cup celebration social distancing. So they were all 2 meters apart. And then Ulmer just went with the cup and just went, yeah! And they all went, yeah! But like all far from each other. It was, well, you know, that's
the Kevin, point out Red Star Belgrade also winning the league this weekend. And
yeah,
not quite social distancing as effectively if you go and you check out some of that video. But please, continue with your team.
Yes. So my midfield three then has Mateus Uribe from Porto as my holding player.
Wait, who are your center backs?
Umtiti and Upamecano.
Oh, okay.
Oh, sorry. Didn't I mention them?
I thought you might have missed
that. Umtiti, yeah. I just thought they were so obvious, you know, the two Frenchmen, Umtiti and Upamecano, my two centre backs, with Ronen and Ulmer at full backs. Then in my midfield three, I've got Uribe as my holding midfielder, Ulvestad from Joe Gardens, the former Norwegian international, on one side. And on the other side, I've got Nache Unuvar, the 16-year-old Ajax prodigy who has made his first team debut in the Cup this season before. I can see you rolling your eyes.
I can't have Okani, but you can have this dude from Ajax who played
his first team. He's played in the first team. No, he hasn't. Yeah. My kid, who, by the way, is a hell of a player and is going to be huge. Well, he's only 16, I should remind you. Trains with the first team, played in the Cup with the first team, does wonders in the reserve Ajax young team, as you know, it's called. And then my front three of Cengiz Under in his right position, which he will love and will surely sign for my team when he knows where you want to play. And then Oot and Uja with him up front.
So there you have it. The letter U. I suspect next week we'll all be swatting up on Belgium and Holland because, of course, it's the V team.
V team, indeed. So,
we got time for, please do go and check out our website. Lots of great content on there. And we have a couple of exciting projects coming up as well. But I haven't been authorized to discuss them yet, but I think you'll find them entertaining. And Jules especially will probably end up loving it. But anyway, I digress. Thanks for being with us. Thanks for sharing your time with us. Be safe and stay alert.